We have survived another week, just barely, I feel like sometimes. It is February 5th. Thanks for joining us for Take Two. Greg Hughes is in the house, and Scott Howell, thanks so much for being with us, gentlemen.
Thanks for the invitation. It's great to be here with
Love
you, Heidi.
Love being here. Scott, have you done this before? Have you been on Take Two on the podcast like
no,
this?
No, I haven't.
This is his first time experience.
So you're a noob.
A Take Two virgin.
He's a noob.
Yeah. So don't take advantage of me.
You got the newbie.
I heard you two hung out earlier in the week, though, so you may have used up all your good fights. But
yeah, we're in high demand, Heidi. Yeah. I don't know what to tell you, but it's
super
we
got to
sign a new contract,
yeah,
Greg.
We got to
renegotiate.
Go get an agent.
We should get on it. So this is not on our list of topics I sent out to you, gentlemen, but this morning I spent my day being a mom because Fridays is homeschool day, and my son's trying out for the soccer team, so we had to jump through the hoops of the test, Utah, or play to test kind of thing. I think if you're in the system correctly, it works really well. I was not mom of the year today, and it took me so many hours. So I'm coming to work being like, oh my gosh, this is going to be the relaxing part of my day. So, woo, we made it through that. So
well,
glad
how
to
awful
be
was it? I mean, really, was it so awful that you couldn't navigate through? Because I've heard different things. And Fridays is when you have virtual.
Yeah,
for all
so
the
we're
schools,
at home,
right?
And yeah. I knew that we had to be there at 9:45. And here's my admittal that I think if we had been to meetings, I would have known what to do. But my son told me after they have these open practices before they have tryouts where you go for a few weeks and you play probably so the coach can really see how you play.
Right.
My son didn't tell me till we were a couple weeks in. So I signed up late, probably didn't hear all the instructions. And so we went and did the COVID testing for the first time today after we've been to a couple practices. And they're like, you're not on the list. So I signed up for an app. I signed up through the Bingham Athletics, and finally we figured out that there was some place to actually sign up for the testing. So once you actually do what you're supposed to do, super slick process, they shove it up your nose, you're in, you're out in a couple
that
of minutes.
That thing's like a yardstick. I'm telling you, the thing is so long. I've seen video
My
of this.
My son said these are like shorter yardsticks, though. He felt like they didn't scratch his brain this
you
time.
You want to motivate people to take precautions. Let them watch one of those things on YouTube, and you're just going
to
do whatever it takes to never
have
that thing
it.
Up your... I mean, it keeps going. It's
horrible.
I've had the pleasure of six times, but probably the most intense was for the vice president's debate.
I feel the same.
Remember, you had to do it
yourself.
Yes.
They kept telling you higher, higher.
Yeah.
And it's like self-inflicted brain scratching.
It was.
Oh. Meanwhile, we got a fly running around the place. I mean, everybody's getting tested. Everything's getting tested, but then they got a fly with who knows what that fly's been sitting on, just crashing the presidential debate.
I got to tell you, Heidi and I had a great experience because we talked about it after. It was like the Olympic, Phil.
It really was.
It was.
There was a buzz to it for sure. Even from watching it on television and seeing it all getting ready, there was a buzz. Even in downtown for the day of, it was.
I know. And speaking of that, Scott Howell is BFFs with Kamala Harris now. So have you guys been hanging out now that she's an actual VP? No,
she's kind of forgotten who Scott Howell is.
See, that's what they do, Scott. That's the Democrats for you. They're just going to leave you high and dry. I'm here to tell you. I'm going to help you.
It's
I'm going to help
good.
You through.
And you know what? I'm kind of happy having them leave me alone for a little while. I thought I was done after the campaign. Then I got thrown in the middle of the inauguration.
Well,
it was crazy.
Hey, it's
so this is exciting, really the first couple of weeks since I've been able to get back to my business. But Heidi, when we were up there, there was this small incident where one of my friends really was quite rude, and I had to go back and slap him a few times and say, do you know who Heidi Hatch is?
That's right.
Do you know who this
watched
woman?
News program.
We did talk about
it. No, and
I'm
serious. I told him that. And I said, oh, we're so sorry. We just this. And I said, sorry's not going to cut it because you don't know what you just missed. And
if you listen to the podcast, you know that Pete Buttigieg ditched me. But the fun thing is that he had a great interview with me when he was here campaigning for president himself. So why he did not want to play with me again, I have no idea, because I think I'm awesome.
Now he's Secretary of Transportation.
Yes.
I just hope he doesn't go Hollywood. That South Bend to Secretary of Transportation is quite the leap. Let's just keep,
Greg,
keep grounded.
I'd be interested in Heidi's opinion, but this was my first experience with him, and we spent quite a bit of time together. Off the chart smart. And just
he's
as
very well
nice.
Spoken, yeah.
Nice. You could see that he was in Oxford, Cambridge, and all of that. And just a nice, nice person.
Well, you can't ascend to what, you know, to the place he's been in as a candidate without having those smarts. So it comes across.
And I love his military experience.
But if he's going to be rude to Heidi, then, you know, we're going to have to work that out.
I wasn't quite sure it was him.
I'm going to tell you this.
I think his people didn't like
it. What I love is that
it was like a chick fight.
Yeah. You know what, though? Yeah. It did come out that Scott was back in your play, Heidi. Scott was not letting that happen. He has Utah's back. He has your back. He has my back.
All right, so if the transportation secretary comes to town, send him my way.
You got it.
All right, I want to talk, while we're talking D.C. right now, a little bit about the $1.9 trillion stimulus. I do want to get to our local issues, but I feel like the stimulus is a local issue. And I'm going to start with you, Scott, because President Biden is pitching $1.9 trillion, which is a lot of money. GOP senators, 10 of them on Monday, including Mitt Romney, met with him and said, hey, how about we think about $600 billion? They scaled back maybe where the spending was. And then he met again, the president, on Wednesday with Democrats. And it seemed to me after they came out of that meeting, they were like, it's $1.9 trillion bust or more. Is there any room in there to negotiate? Are we spending too much money? Where do you see all of this?
Well, to answer both your questions, yes, they're spending way too much money. And I'm not sure if you're a relative with the good Orrin Hatch, but when I ran against him twice, that was my big issue, is being a fiscal hawk. And I am a Democrat. Here, I'll show you the card.
You're card carrying.
I am a card carrying.
I know. What's going on in here? I don't understand this podcast anymore.
But when does it stop? And we have to pay that money back sometime. And I think there has to be a lot of room in there. And I think the president is making mistakes. I really think that he's making big mistakes on what he's doing. And, you know, but what came out of that discussion, all of a sudden Mitt Romney pops out with, well, we're going to do a monthly check to these individuals. And I'm like, kind of going, wait, where are we in politics? But somebody has to pay the bill. Somebody has to pay the bill. And I have always been a fiscal hawk because the responsibility of it, I think the billions, but the $1.2 trillion, I just can't see it.
It is a lot of money. One thing that I thought was interesting, I want to get to Romney's proposal in a minute, but Romney, when he went in there with 10 senators, they brought in some maps of the United States. I should have sent it to you. Yeah. I had his office send it to me. But 47 states reported in what their earnings were from 2019 to 2020 of their tax dollars. And 21 of those 47 states, including the state of Utah, were doing better after 2020 than they were the year before. And he's saying we need more targeted spending because it makes no sense to just like give these states a windfall of money that they really don't need. And I think that's the part where I think maybe we might be missing the boat, where we're just throwing money, but sometimes throwing money does no good because someone like me, I've had a job, I've been at work every day. Do I want a few thousand in my bank account? Yes, but do I need it? No.
Well, I think this is where, and again, I think we're in this season now in the United States where this is where the cynicism of the American people just continues to grow. During the campaign, the presidential campaign, there was a moral imperative. I watched Wolf Blitzer and CNN actually go after Nancy Pelosi, saying, presidential campaigns aside, what are you going to do? We need something. There are people that are suffering. We need to get something done. And she's very offended by the pointed questions coming her way. But you saw this sense of urgency particularly from the media. But today, I do feel like we're talking more about the dollars and it's fine, but the tone has changed. And if we have people in need because government and this pandemic artificially shut down an economy that wasn't a normal cycle of a recession. I mean, this is if government's going to make certain decisions that interrupt people's ability to earn a living, I do think there's a unique relationship where the government has to help walk that through and see how that ends. We know those circumstances are happening in this country. It should be as high of a priority as it was even during the fall, during a presidential election. And I don't see that as much. And then you get to the point where Utah's Senator Mitt Romney, he prided himself of being a fiscal hawk. Yeah, that was one thing that he said, look, you might not like that I can't stand President Trump, but I'm here on the fiscal issues. And then like Santa Claus, I mean, just all of a sudden we're going to start spending for a year. We're going to give everybody a certain amount of money. And I do. I think these conversations have changed. I don't think they're being framed the same way they were before. And I think what ultimately happens when we see this, we're observing this, is people roll their eyes. They're like, it's just politics as usual. It's just, you know, we're not going to see the gap between $600 billion and $1.9 trillion. That's an ocean. of the difference.
You know, Greg makes some really salient points in this, especially when we look at the leisure and hospitality industry. And at no fault of their own, like you just said. And that I think that's the role of government.
Right.
And that is to give that helping hand, not a handout. And so I think, but it has to end somewhere. Heidi, your kids and your grandkids and my grandkids, they're going to be paying for this. And
it's scary.
It is scary.
It is, and I think the thing is if you dial it back to your own budget, whether you live on a budget or not, or you just spend till the money's gone, we all know that there's limits of what we can spend,
right.
And at some point you can only put so much on a credit card. And if you look at that on a grander scale of government, I wish our elected leaders would look at it in the same way they would look at their own family budget, where you wouldn't be spending all this money you knew you couldn't spend back. It just doesn't. It doesn't feel good. It feels scary to me.
I had something really interesting. I posted about this on social media, and I had a couple of, quote, economic leaders say, Scott, quit saying that, because you don't understand. The stimulus, when we get the money out there, the dollars will come back, the revenues will come up. I'm not an economist, but I'm simple enough to know that when I'm out of X, then that's going to end it, and nobody's going to help me. But there is that philosophy out there of some economists that say, you don't understand the bigger picture, that if we get the money out there, they're going to go buy this or buy that, and it's going to stimulate, and it'll come back roaring. But I just don't see that. It doesn't make sense to me.
I think both have tried. Look, it's a strange world when economists are pointing to supply side economics, starting with the government funding it all, and then watch the supply side happen.
And
it's a bizarre
keep
world.
Spending at Amazon, but not at the resorts in Las Vegas.
And it's like,
who's going on a cruise? Yeah. That's what I want to know. Who's taking their money?
So the pain still remains where the pain is.
Right.
Yeah. I don't think they understand what supply side is supposed to mean at that point. But look, look at the other side of it. If you see tax cuts, if they want supply side, leave the money in the household. Let people keep more of what they make. They will spend. They do. They need to. I honestly think, and you've said it too, Scott, where government has stopped, artificially halted a restaurant owner's ability to have customers or whatever, and for the best of reasons. I mean, we can have that debate. That's a different debate. But I'm going to say, when the government comes and interrupts commerce and economic activity, that is not the same as a recession or a downturn or unwise decisions a business owner may make. And I do think that when you decide to do that, you better know how that's supposed to walk its way through. So I do think that's targeted. And I think that there is a role when the government gets involved and stops these things, how they help that through. But we know in Utah from the fiscal analysts, it is not impacting every sector of our economy the same way. And so that's why it should be targeted. And inherently, when you target it, you would see that number of that kind of aid go down a lot.
And I think the stock market is indicative of that. At 3,100 today, who would have thought a year ago when it was at 1,800? And look what it's done, roaring back. If we would all invested in the stock market, we wouldn't be having a conversation.
GameStop, that's where the money's at.
I'll tell you what. Yeah, don't be Robin Hood today, though. They got some splaining to do.
Before we move on, though, I want to focus on the Romney Family Security Act. I've put in a request to do an interview with him because I really want to understand this a little better, because I don't even know if I understand it correctly. But I want to see where you guys stand on this, because families could get up to $3,000 a year in financial support per child that's 16 to 17 years old. I think you could get up to $15,000. He says this won't add to the debt and that it would be kind of like a fiscal
stimulus,
zeroed out. But I don't really understand how that works, because to me, yes, you could get a child credit on your taxes when you claim at the end of the year, so maybe you're getting the money up front. But a lot of those lower income families, the way I understand taxes from, filing myself when I was, making $7 an hour, you're not really paying your taxes. If you make under a certain amount, you're not paying out those thousands of dollars. So aren't we still coming up with that money sort of as a gift or stimulus in itself to a lot of these?
Well, I think that's what we all feel.
Yeah.
Thus, on this side of the conversation, and when you get those charts and Mitt explains it to you, I'd be the first one to say, thank you for explaining it to me, because what it sounds like is it's still a stimulus. And when he says it's not going to hurt the debt, well, there's not going to be those dollars going back in to pay off the debt. And so I think it does hurt the debt, and I think it contributes. So it's one of those issues that I really want to find out more before I make any judgment on it.
And I think it could easily get tacked on, because I think Democrats could essentially just vote this through without any Republican help. And if Democrats like his idea, then they could easily tack it on and it's going to happen. You have children. You live in the great state of Utah. Are you thinking, okay, this is good. This will help the bottom line.
No, Murphy's Law. Two of my three children are gone. Okay. where you been? Where you been when all these rugrats were raiding the pantry, eating all my food? You know, I had some expenses going on.
How does your wife feel about having this help more before? Babies now?
I know. Seriously, is that the economic stimulus we're talking about here? I got to go get this money.
Well, let me call her right now. Hey, would you and Greg like to have a romantic moment tonight?
You know, I'm looking at the age group: 6 to 17 years old. My youngest is literally 17 years old. Is this a bad joke? I mean, how is this happening now? I mean, come on. I feel targeted.
But think about Heidi. We have to think about our host.
I've been harmed.
And our guest, our moderator here. Yeah. She's going to benefit. And you know what? We should support it.
We should support
it. For like a year. I do have a 15-year-old and a 20-year-old.
Oh.
Well, so I'm like out of the window. I'm too old to have more babies, even if they'll pay me money. While we're talking about...
Do we really need to pay Utahns to have more babies? Is that where we're at in life?
No, we're fine.
Okay.
I
thought we were kind of in a groove here. I didn't think we needed any kind of stimulus financially to do this.
Stimulus in a different way. Yeah. Whoa, dictionary. Okay, I want to talk about money while we're talking about handing out dollars. But Jen Psaki, the press secretary, said yesterday that the president continues to support the canceling of student debt to bring relief to students and families. We're talking up to $50,000. I know everyone feels different about this. Where do you stand on this? Is this a good idea? Will it help our country, or is it still digging a hole of money that we're going to have to pay back someday?
The word that I'd say is accountability. And that's what we have to think about. What lessons are we teaching here to kids about what that issue is? Before I left, Linda grabbed me and said, I hope you don't support doing away with this. And I said, no, hon, I don't. But what I would support is a restructuring of that debt.
Of how they pay it?
Of how they pay it, exactly. When I look at some of the terms and conditions on that, and some of the kids who went through private, some went through the federal government, and some of them have debt loads of 5 and 6%, and then I see where we are today. Mm-hmm. And I think a restructuring would be something good. But to just totally wipe it all out, I just don't think that sends the right message for anyone that in the future, what are they going to expectation? Is it going to be a mortgage? Is it going to be that, oh, man, I overshot my credit cards and, you know, somebody needs help? And that might sound hard and that might not sound democratic, but what it does sound is accountability for the future of our country and individuals to know, I can work this out, and let's restructure it. That's where I am on that.
I think that's the interesting part. You look at it, and we've all, you know, gone to school and made that commitment where you either worked your butt off and got a scholarship or, you know, I would work three jobs in the summertime and, you know, eat, you know, nothing but ramen noodles. And you did it to make it happen. And then you think about, you know, someone else who may have chosen a more expensive education that you couldn't afford and knew you couldn't. And then they get to pay it back, but they still signed on the dotted line like you. Is life sometimes not fair, Greg, and we should just pay off the debt?
I will tell you, there's two parts of this for me. You know, when I was going to school, I didn't like to go to public school. I was always trying to ditch class. It always felt terrible to me. I want to go to college, but now you got to pay. You got to pay. And for me, with a family that cannot pay for my tuition, it was Pell Grants and Stafford loans, and I had to do that as well as work. And all of a sudden, you're not going to miss classes or semesters that you're having to pay for or that you're borrowing on.
Accountability.
So, to your point about accountability, I think it absolutely changes the nature of seeking, you know, a higher education because of what you have to do to be able to be in that classroom or on that campus. But I'll tell you this, in Utah, we're spoiled. When we look at what it costs for a semester of college for, you know, institutions of higher learning in Utah, it is so much lower and it is so much more manageable than what we see in other states. I mean, you can go back to Pennsylvania at Appalachian State, which is not some storied university. It's not a bad place. It's $30,000 a semester. And so it's fine for the Biden administration or others to say, look, let's forgive debt. Is anybody looking at the other side of this in terms of the tuition costs at these institutions of higher learning? Why in the world can those institutions not look closer to the type of education, quality education you can get in the state of Utah for tuition rates that aren't cheap, but they're manageable? I mean, I would never as a father be able to help my children in college the way that I am if I was staring at some of those tuition costs in other states. And so I think that, you know, you got to look at that side of this ledger as well in terms of the cost of higher ed. It's getting out of control, or is out of control.
Greg May, and I keep saying he makes a good point. I mean, they're not that good, but they're good.
Yeah, you guys are way too friendly.
I know.
But talk about a deep dive of an industry that needs a wholesale change. That is the industry. Yeah. And if I was still in the legislature, I would be so deep into that. Where does that money go? And we do get a bargain here. Don't get me wrong, but it's still expensive.
It is.
And I just think that when you look at industries that have to go through a whole transition of the way we do it, and do we do deliver virtual now, and really where is that line of what we pay professors, and are we getting the ROI? That's the accountability on that issue that I just think – we do. And, you know, we also have private institutions here that, again, charge really reasonable rates. And
they do.
Every kid in the world wants to go to some of our private institutions here.
But there are ways to improve. I remember during the Republican GOP debates, we were talking to Thomas Wright, who'd served on the Board of Higher Education. And I thought it was interesting that he saw ways to structure and maybe make the state institutions work together. And I think he used the example of marketing, where you could have one person who did it for multiple universities. And I know that that would cost jobs. There obviously would be someone, but hopefully we could soak them up and put them other places, but maybe restructure in a way that we could get our students the education they needed and make it more affordable. So I think if we think outside the box, that maybe we can figure out how to make it happen.
BTW, that was the best hosted debate and moderators in the history of the state of Utah. The highest rating was on that, and we pulled it off with a individual who had COVID. And nobody even knew it went on that stage. But Greg, I watched him, and he got – if everybody would have watched that, but those individuals – no, the Greg Hughes came through of who the Greg Hughes I know. And not this perception that's out there.
Greg was Greg. You are who you are, and I love it.
He was.
Rod was, and that's you, Heidi and Rod. Boy, they were. What
Rod
I loved
was
is
raw.
It was tough.
Oh,
and
it was.
But I embrace that. We've talked about that before. It was truly. I did feel like finally we have a venue here where candidates shoulder to shoulder in that gubernatorial primary could really express their issues and really pushed. You were pushing candidates answer beyond the surface.
Scott helped me with that. It was my first debate, so we did some consulting before and had a lot of
is that Scott?
Talking.
Is he the one that got you get your sharp teeth and your
he
your
did.
Boxing
he actually
gloves
came
out
and over and would like file my teeth at night for me. That was like his
you guys,
main goal.
You were not. It was just. It
but
was
didn't
a tough
she
one.
Do an absolute great job? And the Utah
really
Debate
did.
Commission has a lot to learn from that. Trust me.
You are kind.
We do.
No, and, there was.
It was the
format was
everything. Yep, it was great. So I do remember in that when Greg talked about that very issue, Heidi. And so I didn't mean to swim out of the lane, but I just.
Oh, we can swim wherever we want on this podcast. Okay. I do want to go to the Utah legislature now and talk a little bit about some of those bills. We have a lot going through right now. One of them would require jail time, hefty fines for porch pirates. I don't know where I feel on this because it sucks when someone steals your package, but are we going to fine them? Is this going to do any good? What do you think, Scott?
Oh, I love Gene Davis. He's been up there since Greg was born.
Yeah, I know.
And so, I'm sure, but for a felony, that's a pretty heavy penalty.
I know, especially if they steal your underwear or whatever you get off the porch.
Yeah, exactly.
It's like, give those back. Can
those? I think it does have to be law and order on it. And I think what they really should do is everybody be required to put on Vivint security system or whatever on there. Because that's probably the best way to do
deterrent
to them and light it up. But, it can be a problem when you get some very valuable stuff, Christmas presents and that, the emotion gets in there. Third degree felony, I'm not quite so sure.
What do you think? Throw them away?
Yeah,
lock them up?
I had to put my glasses on to make sure that would be a felony. Not that I am downplaying the theft of packages that
if
arrive on your
yours,
porch.
If it's not yours, don't take it.
Man, I'm just going to say, whoever got him to file that bill, that must have won one heck of a package that got ripped off, because this is like, I'm surprised that it doesn't say capital offense on there. Something was on that porch that someone is pretty ticked off at. But here's the challenge. You've seen justice reform. You've seen policymakers, and you've seen this federally.
Yeah.
As well as our state got involved with this in 2015, there is a severity to a felony. that really does change trajectory in your life, your employment, everything that you do.
Yeah.
Everything.
And let me tell you, if we think that the word misdemeanor is a light sentence, a Class A misdemeanor is pretty is pretty serious. I mean, some of the offenses that are Class A misdemeanors, I think would make the hair on your neck stand up. These are not excused.
Isn't a DUI a Class A misdemeanor?
It is.
It is.
And I'm going to tell you that when you look at those, it is not a Class A misdemeanor is not something that's seen as an infraction. It is a serious, serious crime. So, you know, the idea that we have to enforce people that are stealing from these porches, especially with home delivery happening as much as it is, I can totally concur. To go up to a level, if you were to take some of these Class A misdemeanors and put them shoulder to shoulder with the theft of a package on a porch, I think any reasonable person would conclude it doesn't match. And it's a little so you just got to find that right spot where you would want to appropriately you find justice and punish people that would steal from your porch.
Let's stay in the jail lane, Greg. So it looks like the legislature may have gotten something wrong about how people bail out. They're looking at that again.
Yes.
Was it screwed up? Should we leave it as is? Talk to me about this.
And for purposes of full disclosure, I am helping the sheriffs this year. Side of angels. I'm helping out the sheriffs.
Are you that L word? I think he's got the L word.
He's turned into a dirty lobbyist.
Here's a fact. Anyone listen to the show, I am everybody's foil, okay? I am the bad guy for everybody, you know, left of center. They all, hey, my God. So, and an abundance of caution so they can't cry and yell. I like to think of myself working public policy, but I'll go ahead and file if it means that that's what I'm going to, you know, someone's going to accuse me of. But here's the issue. In law enforcement, there was a bill that was passed with an impressive list of stakeholders that run the gamut of a criminal justice system. So you had the judiciary, you had prosecutors, you had law enforcement, you had the defense attorneys, you had indigent defense, you had ACLU, you had, you go down the list. It was, I think it was just about everyone. And they said, you know what? And this is the premise that I think is absolutely the reason why the bill passed last year. If you are pulled over for a low-level offense, let's say you failed to appear for, you had a speeding ticket in some small town. It didn't make its way into the DMV database. Mm-hmm. Years later, you're driving, you get a ticket, and all there's this failure to appear warrant. We would not want, and I've never met a single person that would want to see that individual incarcerated in a county jail without the ability to, maybe if their household income, they can't pay bail, to lose their employment, to lose their job, and see a trajectory in their lives go so bad on something that's a low level like that. And it really is because of their household income and if they could have made bail or not. So there was this collective will with the legislature that they wanted to address that very issue. The bill did not become law till October 1st of 2020. But in these 4 months since that bill has become law, it has truly become the worst of all worlds. You have people with low-level offenses that should have been released on their own recognizance that have sat in jail for over a day, a couple days. You've had people that were arrested with evidence being pulled out of the home with hidden cameras just tragically in children's bedrooms and bathrooms, and an hour and 50 minutes before they're left out, they're let out on what they call an unsecured bond. You know what an unsecured bond is? It's a pinky swear. You sign, I promise I will be really good if you let me out of here. And so think about victims. Think about, you know, the people that should, for purposes of public safety, not have an hour and 50 minutes there and a pinky swear to get out versus someone in a low-level offense that's in there for over a day. So it was having unintended consequences where every one of those stakeholders that supported the bill last year, none of them think that this law is delivering as advertised. Now, there's different ideas of what we should do next, but a bill passed the floor today. Representative Schultz and the House passed a bill that says we're going to repeal that bill, but with the absolute intention on the record and with getting the stakeholders together to understand, like a black box in a plane that would crash, why was this bill misinterpreted, or why was its implementation so faulty? Why did that happen? And once you figure out why, now you know how to build the bill. So you have everybody that wants to get this right. Nobody's happy with the status quo, but it in criminal justice system, there is a human toll when you get these types of things wrong. Oh, yeah. And we got to get it right. And so I was very happy to see it. Over 2/3 of the House concur, get that bill through. But make no mistake, this isn't a repeal to go back to a status quo. Right. But this is we're resolved, and they are resolved to see that this is done the right way.
So, Scott, is this how it should work if they messed it up, to do it again, or did they rush it through last time? And
Well,
naughty, naughty.
What happens, the emotions get so high up there on Capitol Hill that when the people in leadership, like Greg and I both were, you keep saying, what's the unintended consequences? And people don't slow down enough to see what it could be. But this is a perfect example of democracy working, and we made a mistake, and guess what? We're going to go back and rectify. We will go back, and we will rectify what has happened. And that's what I love about our system here. But it takes courage, and it takes leaders. In full disclosure, I'm a lobbyist. I've been for about, I don't know, the last 10 years or
hanging
whatever.
Hanging out with two dirty lobbyists.
Look at it, just
But the role of someone, the invaluable historical things that Greg has learned over the years, made this happen so it can correct it. And no, it was a bill that probably nobody thought about those unintended consequences, went back up, and whoever group is Greg was with, they did the right thing. And yeah. Two-thirds, Heidi, that's a big vote.
That is a big vote. One thing that we've been looking at, too, there were some committee meetings last night and moving into today some more votes. We've got a lot of police reform bills on tap. We've got 84, 162, 38, 13. There's probably more. There's data reporting. We're looking at mental health, training of police dogs, a lot of them. Is there one that rises to the top to you where, like, if we have to pass something, this is really where the focus should be?
The one that that comes to mind for me is to have more mental health workers engaged. To be with officers and let them you do their magic of what they've been trained to do. And I like that bill a lot because I think that's probably something that we've been missing over the years is having that mental health social worker, whatever, right there with the public safety officer. I saw the 9-year-old girl, we all saw that back in Ohio, who, you know, they handcuffed her and then they pepper sprayed her. And there's just too many. And then the guy who got shot, the 13-year-old kid, police officer,
young autistic boy here.
Yeah, young autistic boy. And so I think that's a wise move, is to have those mental health. And look, I want to say this right now. I am 110% against defunding the police. And a card carrying, I'm going to have to pull out my credentials.
I know, seriously.
Yeah, but I am about reform. And reform would be to take those dollars and invest that in some mental health issues. Chief Tom Ross out in Bountiful, and now he's the CCJJ leader.
Yep.
When he understands this concept. When he would arrest people who had mental health issues, he didn't take them to jail. He took them to a light jail and let them have this time to work through the problems. They had social workers there. They had detox people. And I'm glad that Spencer pointed into that position.
That's a big deal.
It is a big deal.
The Commission on Criminal and Juvenile Justice, they typically, there's not a lot of empathy on the law enforcement side. They're almost like different silos, the state's agency on criminal and juvenile justice versus those on the ground that are really trying to protect the peace and enforce public safety. To have former Bountiful Chief of Police Tom Ross, who was the president of the Chiefs of Police, and I worked with very closely on issues when I served, to have his empathy and his understanding on both sides now, that is an incredibly important.
It is a win-win for everybody.
It really is. And so I'm happy to see him there. And I do think that some of these reforms or some of these things that we're talking about are going to be done in the right spirit, given that perspective.
But for defunding, absolutely not. No. And the biggest mistake I say on elected officials in Salt Lake was to take that $5 million out. And that $5 million should have been put back into social workers, the dog keepers, whatever those are. But to take that money out, what a message it sent to criminals. You know, if I keep doing these protests and I keep doing this and that, maybe we'll get it all defunded. Our society is based on law and order. Now, did the police, have there been things that have been wrong? Yeah. At IBM, where I was, I had salespeople who did things wrong. I mean, we've probably all done something that we wish we hadn't have.
There's bad apples in every industry.
Thank you, Heidi. Yeah. Thank you. And that's exactly it. But on the most part, I think our public safety officers, the ones I've known, the ones Greg's known, because we've been pretty much like-minded on these people, they're good people, and they want to serve. They want to do the best.
It's true. And look, this you pointed, Scott, to this national narrative that we're seeing, whether it's defund the police or this narrative that the law enforcement can be our, or they are the enemy or they could be the enemy. I mean, I'm telling you, I'm on the side of I need public safety and yeah. And just because that's how your kids get to school. That's how you have businesses open. That's how yeah. life goes. You need the stability of a safe community and society. This year, we have over 80 bills that are looking to be very prescriptive about how law enforcement will
do their move,
how they will get up off of a chair, how they'll do anything. It is an avalanche of bills that reflect kind of the national narrative we're in and even in our state. So what I'll tell you is that Speaker Wilson, he did a press conference or put out a press release stating three very important bills that involve reform in law enforcement that he is supporting. And as I look, even the law enforcement community is getting behind these. 16 out of 40 hours that are annual
yeah.
training
yeah.
or for behavioral
yeah.
health
behavioral
and
health.
How to de-escalate yeah. some right. of these situations right. going on that are emerging right now, which right. is rock solid
right.
and we can all get and rally behind. There's the other issues are the misuse of evidence or yeah. if things are happening where law enforcement is acting outside of their role in public safety and they're doing I'm pointing to the tragedy that happened at the U.
Sure.
But there was evidence there, and it was passed sure. along. Those things cannot happen, and there needs to be a particular focus on making sure that, you know, things like that aren't being abused. And so there's that support. And then the other one was the data. So making sure – see, one of the things that's tough in when we talk about the criminal justice system – is that just because you don't count it doesn't mean it's not happening, or just because you're not measuring.
They need to be tracking it statewide.
Yes,
yeah.
The data piece in law enforcement and public safety has to get better, has to be more robust. And so there's a bill looking to do that. Those bill sponsors on those three bills have done their work. They've gone and interfaced with law enforcement. They have support from within the industry, within the law enforcement community. You have political support. But of the 84... I'm going to tell you, there's a lot of them that don't go through that process, and then that's where the cumulative effect happens,
well,
and we got to be very careful.
Unintended consequences.
Yes.
I do like the bill about canine handling and to make sure that that's responsible. But when you talk about data, Heidi, this is really critical. Greg and I have been on the same page to go in and get that data for homeless. We you know, how they measure things in a homeless shelter is based upon the number of sanitary kits they pass on, the number of beds that they have filled, all of those type of things. So it is in public safety. We need that data to make sure we have measurable outcomes so we know where the problems are.
And standardize. We've been
and
doing some stories on that too here at KUTV where you're like, how many murders happened in the state of Utah?
That was a great question that night.
And the question is, we don't know because we're not tracking it. And I'm just thinking, we all have a smartphone in our hand and a computer. How are we at the point where we're not compiling this data? And so I think a lot of it is accountability, keeping up with what we need to, and then realizing too that our police officers, they fill a lot of roles, and we have to be careful probably about every role and how they do their jobs, because we want them to be accountable. We want them to be living up to the standards, we hope. And then we also have to realize that we're giving them a lot of jobs to do, and they're not going to do them all perfectly unless we give them the help they need.
I love that interview that you guys did with Commissioner Anderson, and he said, I don't know how many murders there are, because the way they report up, we don't get the data on time. We don't ever know.
Yeah.
That was probably one of the best in-depth interviews I have ever seen about the issue, and everybody
how
should be.
How can you address, if you're not measuring in any kind
that's
of
it.
Adequate way,
that's
how
it.
Can you address something that's critical and should be a priority if you can't measure it, and if you can't measure what's actually happening? I've been surprised in some of the more foundational data points that you would think would be so readily available to make decisions as a policymaker or even as a citizen advocate. Many of those data points are not available, which you should be worried
simple.
About.
And to all of our listeners, when Heidi Hetch became the new anchor, the ratings went up. And so they were able to,
they
to charge
it.
More. They
right.
measured
right.
I bet you
we
she gets
measure
measured
every
single
that's right.
day of every episode of everything you have.
We do. And yeah. actually, if you want to know what the ratings were yesterday, I watched my show specifically at 5, 6, and 10 p.m. We were number one at 5, 6, and not at 10 p.m. And I know tomorrow or tonight I'm going to work harder. And
but that's my point.
Make sure
Heidi, that's my.
That's,
yeah. How would you like to
knowing
work?
Knowing that, that's what you do.
Yeah. How would you like to work for an organization that never measures you? You're going to go, oh, yeah, I might show up to work on time. I might not.
Knowledge is power.
Exactly.
It really is.
It really is. And I should say those were the full rating household numbers. The demos 25 to 54 won't come out till tomorrow. So hopefully 25 to 54
year olds. You hear this, Scott? She's a computer over here.
I was just going to say, well, who's watching?
That's the general household. The 25 to 54 data. Blah, blah,
blah, blah. That's who we sell to. So, well, we want everyone to watch. It's really all about those people.
Buying power.
But think about, what if you were the police chief? Wouldn't you want to have that every day?
Absolutely.
Every day.
Absolutely.
And if you were the homeless director,
yeah,
the homeless leader, I mean, you'd want all of that. So, you know,
you would want all that because you'd make a phenomenal homeless director.
Amen.
You
and
would.
You'd have accountability.
Yep.
Not me. Not me. No. I got to correct that for the record. No, I have no interest.
We are shopping for someone. Hey, we are almost out of time, but there was one issue I want to talk about because we have Scott with us here today. The Dixie name change. A lot of people are talking about this, saying leave it alone. Dixie is the southern part of Utah, and it's okay. It's been our name forever. Scott, you said you went there and played football.
I did.
Do we need to change the name? Have we come to a point in society where it's time to walk away from the word Dixie, or is it okay?
Well, I can tell you there's two good arguments. If you look at the culture down there of the senior citizens, this is their heritage. This is their life. So yeah. I acknowledge that. I believe that. But on the other hand, the data that we had from Cicero was overwhelming from every group of individuals you could ever survey, from employers, from professors, from community leaders, alumni, new students. I mean, it went on and on. Overwhelming. End racism. And I'll just go with Elder Oak's word, end racism. And this is a part of it. And whether we like it or not, or we think it's counterculture, or we don't think it is, I can tell you that we have to end that, and there's so many great names you could have for that university that would reflect where it is. It's actually a technology leader now.
So give me your name. What would you call it?
Well, I haven't picked any, but some of that I've heard is Red Rock University, Majestic Zion University.
I want them to be the Red Devils.
Cool. So, but I just think it's time, and it's something we need to do. And again, I completely acknowledge the sentiment of that community down there. But when you have students come back and say, "Can I just put down DSU and not put Dixie State University?" That's a telltale sign on the resumes of when they go to.
So I'll tell you, I will defer to some degree to an alum. I mean, you went there, so but my point is this: to the alumni, to the people that have lived in that community, you have the word Dixie across the Red Rock in that town. I don't know if they're going to go, sandblast that off or what's going to happen next.
The big D will stay.
So, but what I would say is this: the timing of the world we live in right now.
Yeah.
It could be easily confused with with our tearing down of our founding fathers' statues and all the other new narratives where we're holding our history to what we see the world as today. And I would either like to weather that storm and have this thoughtful discussion because I think there are very valid points that have been made. But in the climate we're in, I think that it's easy for some to fear that they are getting caught up in that movement. But at the end of the day, Scott, I think it's best for the people in Utah to look to those that are alumni who have that degree that have to, whether it's to an employer or where they tell people that, they got their education from, but from the community as well that lives there and how they feel. And I think that as long as that is a name change or a decision made from those that it most directly impacts or affects, or been part of their lives, that's where you want that decision made. What you'd hate to see is someone that is detached from any of that attached sentiment that the community doesn't feel that they either, if they don't like it, they must be racist. If they do like it,
yeah.
then they're not racist. I just think that's kind of the politics of it that I hate to see happening right now. And that's so I just love it to be a homegrown decision, whatever way they want to go.
That's the Greg Hughes that's so thoughtful, Heidi. I mean, think about that conversation, what
you
he
two
just
are too
said.
Agreeable
well, no, we're not because, I mean, at the end of the day, let's just rip off the scab and get this done and move on.
Yeah.
Because we have studied it over years. But what Greg said, you have to acknowledge that these people have, this is their life. And I had a woman call me and say, well, my my daughter's named Dixie, so do I have to change your name? I said, well, my aunt's name is Dixie, too, and we just love her, and we never think about that. But you have that emotional appeal that goes on. So I hope they'll pass it. I hope we can move on.
Yeah.
I hope Congress can get along like you two. Because really, if we could just sit down and talk issues and stop trying to wear an R or D on our chest and like be team this or team that, I feel like there's more common ground out there, don't you think?
It is a secret of public policy. Scott Howe was a Democrat minority leader in the Senate. I was a leader in the House. And I'll tell you that if you look at most bills that are being run, sessions going on right now, they pass bipartisan supermajority. Most bills do. You have controversial bills, but most of them, if the lawmaker is doing their work, they don't fit neatly in a respective political party's platform. It's just policy and problem solving. That's what you'd like to see more in Washington, D.C. And it does happen in our state all the time.
Yeah,
we spend more time and attention on the things we don't agree on. But
right. But
just know the underlying work that's being done on behalf of the people, I would argue whether it's your legislature, your city councils, your county commissions or councils, I think that work happens every day.
Heidi, I think it can be summed up real easy. Common sense. And most people are either a center left or center right. They're not the extreme. But, you know, that's part of our democracy.
Heidi, isn't this so different than when DeBacchus is here? He's just like he's got like a cricket bat in here just swinging it at me, you know? It's just like so different.
Is, I think Jim is a lot more centrist than he likes to make people think he is.
He is. He is. Trust me.
Yep.
He is. And from a business perspective, don't tread on his business or cut his revenues, or he knows how the world works.
Let's just pick on Jim. That's an awesome topic. That's what I love.
Give us one of your vacation homes.
Yeah, exactly.
We're holding you for a ransom.
Yes.
Oh, gosh. Well, thank you, everyone, for hanging out, making Fridays fun again, talking politics. Is politics fun? It can be, right?
Yes.
That's right.
Yes. And productive, too.
And honorable.
Heidi, yeah, and honorable. And thank you for hosting. And what a delight to be with you. And I say this with all sincerity. You and Rod were some of the best moderators. I've been on the debate commission from its beginning. And that really was, it set a new bar for us, and we needed to have that. So thank you.
Well, thank you for your help, and thank you for the kind compliments heading into this weekend, making me feel all perky and happy. Thanks for being with us. Tell your friends to give out the podcast and subscribe.